You know, there's a reason for cautionary tales.
Then why don't more people heed their warnings?
I don't know. But after they hear my new show, they will think twice.
Oh yeah? About what?
Eating Tide Pods, playing with Ouija boards, talking to Karens, you name it. If you should heed caution, we're talking about it.
Check out Harper's brand new podcast, Cautionary Tales with Harper. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you download podcasts.
And be sure to press subscribe and give us a review.
Cautionary Tales with Harper.
Subscribe wherever you download podcasts today.
What should have been a luxury cruise aboard a prestigious Italian cruise liner, the final voyage of the Andrea Doria was a shocking one. Plagued by errors, cover-ups, incompetence, and horrible luck, the ship would eventually end up on the floor of the ocean near Nantucket, along with the souls of 46 passengers on board. Today, the story of the wreck of the Andrea Doria on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the dark side of Wikipedia.
The SS Andrea Doria was an ocean liner for Italian Line, homeported in Genoa, Italy, known for her sinking in 1956 when 46 people died. Named after the 16th century Genoese Admiral Andrea Doria, the ship had a gross registered tonnage of 29,100 and a capacity of 1,200 passengers and 500 crew. For a country attempting to rebuild its shattered economy and reputation after World War II, Andrea Doria was an icon of Italian national pride. Of all Italy's ships at the time, Andrea Doria was the largest, fastest, and supposedly safest. Launched on the 16th of June 1951, the ship began her maiden voyage on January 14th, 1953. On July 25th, 1956, while Andrea Doria was approaching the coast of Nantucket, Massachusetts, bound for New York City, the eastbound Stockholm and the Swedish-American line collapsed with her, one of history's most infamous maritime disasters. Struck in the side and top-heavy, Andrea Doria immediately started to list severely starboard, which left half of her lifeboats unusable. The consequent storage of lifeboats could have resulted in significant loss of life, but the ship stayed afloat for over 11 hours after the collision. The calm, appropriate behavior of the crew, together with improvements in communications and the rapid response of other ships, averted a disaster similar in scale to that of the Titanic in 1912. While 1,660 passengers and crew were rescued and survived, 46 people died on the ship as a direct consequence of the collision. The evacuated luxury liner capsized and sank the following morning. The accident remains the worst maritime disaster to occur in United States waters since the sinking of Eastland in 1915. The incident and its aftermath were heavily covered by the news media. While the rescue efforts were both successful and commendable, the cause of the collision with Stockholm and the loss of Andrea Doria generated much interest in the media and many lawsuits, largely because an out-of-court settlement agreement between the two ships companies during hearings immediately after the disaster, no determination of cause was ever formally published. Although greater blame appeared initially to fall on the Italian liner, more recent discoveries have indicated that a misreading of radar on the Swedish ship initiated the collision course, leading to errors on both ships. So it is the dark side of Wikipedia, and here we go, jumping into the wreck of the Andrea Doria. It's one that I was kind of fascinated with a bit as a kid. I didn't know a whole lot about it, but Titanic was my jam, and I had every book on it and would borrow them from the library. But anything that had to do with a commercial ship disaster, I was totally into. It's a weird fascination for a child, but it is what it was. Tony and Sean joining you on today's episode. Be sure to press whatever, or be sure to press subscribe, whatever platform it is you're listening on. Knowledge, thoughts on the Andrea Doria?
So welcome to first day of second grade. My name is Miss Johnson. Classmates, introduce yourselves. Oh, Tony. Yeah, Sean. Oh, what do you like, Sean? I like Pokemon. I like trolls. I like to play baseball. Tony, I love ships that wreck in the ocean, particularly commercial. Yes. Pre-1900. It is just so exhilarating. Allow me to talk to myself here for 4 hours and do a radio show. Kids, why are you running away? Tony he's nice. He's just different.
Include him in kickball.
Don't pick him last.
Which happened.
That will just feed his ego to do a ratings-winning morning show later in life. This is scary stuff, man. I mean, when you think about it, you have obviously there's accidents with trucks and cars and automobiles. You then have airplanes, and you have maritime accidents. Airplanes, yeah, they're in the air. They can pretty much be kind of doing whatever. But there's so much GPS. There's so much tracking. There's air traffic control. It's a little bit more regimented. Back in the day, and even current day, these commercial ships, just the size, and they're out in the... That is absolutely terrifying. And quite honestly, I mean, I can't imagine why there aren't even more where you're middle of the night. It's not like you have a lot of lights on your ship, on your vessel, aside from just on the tip and the end there. It's terrifying, but that's not my thing. Some people don't like to fly. I don't like to be, I never would want to go on a cruise.
Yeah.
That absolutely terrifies me.
I feel totally comfortable on ships. It doesn't scare me, but what does scare me is when you hear about just how kind of loose and lax sometimes the rules can be depending on the cruise line that you're sailing on, like the Costa Concordia, how it really turned out like that thing went really close to land. And there's no air traffic controller or sea traffic controller saying you can't take the ship over there. There's a fucking bed of rocks. But
you would like to think that there's air horns that go off.
Something.
I mean, when you have airplanes that go off, you know, even 1,000 feet, there's fighter jets that will intercept commercial aircraft.
But the whole reason that the Costa Concordia tipped over in recent years was because he went too close to the land where he shouldn't have. And he was trying to do a salute to a town and impress a woman that he had in the whatever the you call the place where you steer the ship. I don't know if it's the cockpit. Maybe that's something I should know. But the bridge, I don't know. But he was trying to do that. So it was more like a look at me. Oh, shit. I think we just hit a rock and now the ship's tipping over. It's like it's just shocking that one individual could do such. You're steering a city of people. I mean, the Andrea Doria in terms of size compared to what's out in the waters today is very small. But today you have these massive, you know, 10,000 people plus ocean liners, and you got one person, and you better damn well hope they know what they're doing and that they're a good, reputable person. And then sometimes you hear like the history of some of the folks, and it's like, really? That qualified them to be the captain of a fucking ship that like, like that's all it took? I mean, it's just shocking. But some liners are much more restrictive on who they hire, and some are not. So I think you kind of got to do your research on what cruise line you go on, and I think discount cruises are probably out of the question.
I don't know enough about maritime vessels. Is there, similar to airplanes, you have your captain and co-pilot or first officer?
Yeah.
Is there a co-captain? To my knowledge, it's whoever has the wheel.
Yeah.
You're it. I don't know of a, you know, assistant captain or a captain, if you will.
There's a captain, and he's like the law of the land. He is the judge, the juror, and, you know, everything. And, you know, he'll take his breaks and stuff, and then you have someone who will, you know, I don't know if it's like co-captain or what it is, but all ultimate decisions, you'd wake up your captain unless he's incapacitated, then the other one would take over. But other than that, it's like, nope, he's still the president, even though he's sleeping. And he's the one that, you know, he rule, it's maritime law, and he is the ruler of that floating ship or city. And then you have a ton of people, you know, different crew that do different things up in that area. But there's a lot of people involved in moving, you know, one of those things today, which is just, it makes it shocking, like something like Costa Concordia could have happened. It makes it shocking that something like Andrea Doria could have happened, that you could get these two giant vessels that close to each other by accident. I understand, like, when they're trying to dock these fucking things in rough waters at a port of call and one bumps into the other. That, I think, could happen very easily. And it does happen quite frequently. But I don't know, when you're out on the water, it's like, that takes a special level of ignorance to make that one happen.
You'd like to think if you are, and even back then, I would imagine there's some type of coordinates or some type of tracking system, radar, sonar. But if you're looking out the window and you see, you'd have to imagine you'd see another ship getting closer.
Yeah.
Maybe you want to hang a left here.
I don't know if it's a lot of assumption that the other one's going to turn, and it almost turns into an unintentional game of chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, oh, shit. And it's too late or what? But, I mean, it doesn't happen super frequently. Thank goodness. I mean, that would really be kind of scary if they were going down left and right. In modern times, they don't. But prior to modern times, ships went down all the fucking time. You know, that was a big, big thing. But luckily we have information that can tell us, you know, mainly radar, where the weather patterns are at, that being one of the biggest factors, and where you should and should not be going, and also where the other ships are in relation to each other. I mean, and those are all things that are really relative to the last, you know, 30, 40 years in terms of getting super, super accurate, as opposed to just somebody coming over a radio or a telegraph, and then it, you know, being transported to the bridge from the telegraph station, and then read that, and it's already a little bit old by the time it gets there, and then should you follow it or not? And that's, you get into tons of issues like you had with Titanic and such. Anyway, let's continue on with the story of the Andrea Doria and learn a little bit about what the ship was and then what happened to it on its final voyage. Andrea Doria had a length of 212 meters, a beam of 27 meters, and a gross registered tonnage of 29,100 pounds. The propulsion system consisted of steam turbines attached to twin screws, enabling the ship to achieve a service speed of 23 knots with a top speed of 26 kilometers per hour. Andrea Doria was neither the largest vessel nor the fastest of its day. The distinctions went to RMS Queen Elizabeth and the United States, respectively. Instead, the famous Italian Minoletti designed Andrea Doria for luxury. Because it sailed the southern Atlantic routes, Andrea Doria was the first ship to feature three outdoor swimming pools, one for each class, first cabin and tourist. When fully booked, the ship was capable of accommodating 1,241 passengers in three different classes, 218 in first class, 320 in cabin class, and 703 in tourist class. It was the rule aboard transatlantic passenger liners. Each passenger class was strictly segregated to specific parts of the ship. First class accommodations were located amidship on the upper decks. Cabin class accommodations were located just abaft the first class, and tourist class accommodations were divided between the bow and aft ends and were connected by corridors that ran the full length of the ship. Each class had its own separate dining room, lounges, and social halls, designated areas of open deck space, and enclosed promenades, and even their own swimming pools with verandas. In addition, 563 crew members were charged with operating and maintaining the ship. Over $1 million was spent on artwork and the decor of the cabins and public rooms, including a life-size statue of Admiral Doria. Safety and seaworthiness. Equipped with a double hull, Andrea Doria was divided into 11 watertight compartments. Any two of these could be filled with water without endangering the ship's safety. Andrea Doria also carried enough lifeboats to accommodate all passengers and crew. She carried a total of 16 steel lifeboats, 8 positioned on each side of the ship, coming in 3 different designs, 2 58-person launches for emergency use, 2 70-person motorboats with inboard radio transmitters, and 12 146-person hand-propelled standard boats. Furthermore, the ship was equipped with the latest early warning radar. However, despite its technological advantages, the ship had serious flaws relating to its seaworthiness and safety. Confirming predictions delivered from model testing during the design phase, the ship developed a huge list when hit by any significant force. This was especially apparent during its maiden voyage when Andrea Doria listed 28 degrees after being hit by a large wave off Nantucket. The ship's tendency to list was accentuated when the fuel tanks were nearly empty, which was usually at the end of a voyage. This stability issue became a focus of the investigation after the sinking, as it was a factor in both the capsizing and the crew's inability to lower the portside lifeboats. The bulkheads of the watertight compartments extended only up to the top of A deck, and a list greater than 20 degrees allowed water from a flooded watertight compartment to pass over its top into adjacent compartments. In addition, the design parameters allowed the lowering of the lifeboats at a maximum of 15 degrees list. Beyond this limit, up to half of the lifeboats could not be deployed. At the end of World War II, Italy had lost half its merchant fleet through wartime destruction and Allied forces seeking war reparations. The losses included the scuttling bombing of Rex, a former blue ribboned holder. Furthermore, the country was struggling with a collapsed economy. To show the world that the country had recovered from the war, and to reestablish the nation's pride, the Italian line commissioned two new vessels of similar design in the early 1950s. The first was to be named Andrea Doria, after the 16th century Genoese admiral Andrea Doria. The second vessel, which was launched in 1953, was named Cristoforo Colombo, after explorer Christopher Columbus. These ships were intended to enter use on the Italian line's main service between Genoa and New York, which was commonly advertised as the Sunny Southern Route, alongside Sutrina, Vulcania, and Conate Bianco, which were among the handful of Italian liners to survive the war. However, as popular as these vessels were, all three were more than two decades old and had somewhat slower service speeds. Thus, it was the line's intention to use the new Andrea Doria and Cristoforo Colombo to establish a new express service to New York. While the three older liners followed a route that meandered throughout the Mediterranean and additional stops at ports, including the Azores, Lisbon, Barcelona, Palermo, and two new faster ships would make only three ports of call between Genoa and New York at Cannes, Naples, and Gibraltar. Doria started as yard number 918 at Eslando Shipyard in Genoa. On the 9th of February 1950, the ship's keel was laid on the number one slipway, and on June 16, 1951, Andrea Doria was launched. During the ceremony, the ship's hull was blessed by Giuseppe Suri, Cardinal Archbishop of Genoa, and christened by Mrs. Giuseppia Surrogate, wife of the former minister of the Merchant Marine, Giuseppe Surrogate. Initially, Andrea Doria had been scheduled to depart Genoa on her maiden voyage on the 14th of December, 1952, but amid reports of machinery problems during sea trials, the departure was delayed to January 14, 1953. Following the Italian line's advertised route, she collected 794 passengers before heading into the open Atlantic for New York. During the ship's maiden voyage, she encountered heavy storms on her final approach to New York, listing a full 28 degrees. Nevertheless, Andrea Doria completed her maiden voyage on January 23rd, only a few minutes behind schedule, and received a welcoming delegation that included New York Mayor Vincent R. Imperiality. The 51st westbound crossing of Andrea Doria to New York began as a typical run on the North Atlantic. Her most recent eastbound crossing from New York had concluded on the 14th of July, and after a three-day turnaround, the ship was prepared to make another trek across the Atlantic, which was scheduled to begin from Genoa on the Tuesday of July 17th. On this run, she was booked to roughly 90% of her total passenger capacity, with 1,134 passengers traveling aboard her, 190 in first class, 267 in cabin class, and 677 in tourist class. With a crew of 572, the total of 1,706 persons were aboard. On the morning of July 17th, boarding at the pier at Genoa began at 8 a.m. as Andrea Doria took her first batch of passengers. In all, 277 passengers embarked at Genoa, 49 first class, 72 cabin, 156 tourist. Among those boarding in first class were Hungarian ballet dancers Evstan Rybalski, Nora Kovac, who had defected from the Soviet bloc to the United States just 3 years earlier. Andrea Doria departed Genoa at 11 a.m. on her first leg of the journey. Her first port of call was Cannes on the French Riviera, where she arrived in mid-afternoon that same day. Only a handful of passengers boarded there, 48 in all. 30 first class, 15 cabin, and only three tourists. Among them was one of Andrea Doria's most famous passengers, Hollywood actress Ruth Roman, who was traveling with her three-year-old son, Richard. From Cannes to Andrea Doria, then proceeded 400 nautical miles to the southeast of Naples, where she arrived later the following morning to take on the bulk of her passengers. A total of 744 came aboard at Naples, 85 in first class, 161 in cabin, and 498 in tourist. Most of those in tourist class were immigrants from impoverished regions of southern Italy on their way to new lives in America. She departed Naples just after 6 p.m., making her final port of call 2 days later while dropping anchor off Gibraltar. After collecting her final 65 passengers, she proceeded on to open Atlantic for New York. And on Wednesday, the 25th of July, just before noon, Stockholm, a passenger liner of the Swedish-American line, departed New York Harbor on her 103rd eastbound crossing of the Atlantic to her home in Sweden. At 12,165 tons and 160 meters in length, roughly half the size of Andrea Doria, Stockholm was the smallest passenger liner on the North Atlantic to run during the 1950s. Completed in 1948, Stockholm was a much more practical design than Andrea Doria. Originally built to accommodate only 395 passengers in two classes, Stockholm was designed more for comfort than the luxury and opulence found on board Andrea Doria. Because the Swedish-American line was aware that the age of the transatlantic passenger travel was coming to an end with the rapid growth of air travel, however, they did not envision the massive surge in tourism that arose during the 1950s. As a result, the Swedish-American line withdrew Stockholm from service in 1953 for an overhaul that included an addition to her superstructure to provide space for accommodations for an additional 153 passengers, including her maximum passenger capacity to 548. This proved to be a successful move, as by 1956, Stockholm had gained a worthy reputation on the North Atlantic. Also because the Stockholm sailed close to the Arctic Ocean, it was designed with a strong ice-breaking bow, which turned out to be a major factor in her survival and the fatal damage to Andrea Doria. Stockholm left New York almost booked to capacity with 534 passengers and a crew of 208. She was commanded by Captain Harry Gunnar Norderson, though Third Officer John Ernst Carstens Johansson was on duty on the bridge at the time of the accident. This was his first time alone on the bridge of a ship, and he had been up since 6 that morning supervising baggage loading and passenger boarding in New York. Stockholm was following her usual course south of the Nantucket Lightship at a speed of about 18 knots with clear skies. Meant to save time, this course nonetheless set the Stockholm 20 miles north of the recommended eastbound course for ships leaving the U.S., meaning that the ship sailed straight into incoming westward traffic. This was a clear violation of the 1953 North Atlantic Track Agreement, to which the Swedish-American line was signatory. Carstens Johansson estimated visibility at 6 nautical miles. As Stockholm and Andrea Doria were approaching each other head-on in the heavily used shipping corridor, the westbound Andrea Doria had been traveling in heavy fog for hours. The captain had reduced speed slightly from 23 to 21.8 knots, activated the ship's fog warning whistle, and had closed the watertight doors, all customary precautions while sailing in such conditions. However, the eastbound Stockholm had yet to enter what was apparently the edge of the fog bank and was seemingly unaware of it and the movement of the other ship hidden within the fog. The waters of the North Atlantic south of Nantucket Island are frequently the site of intermittent fog as cold Labrador current encounters the Gulf Stream. As the two ships approached each other at a combined speed of 40 knots, in flailing light, each was aware of the presence of another ship, but guided only by radar, they apparently misinterpreted each other's course. No radio communication was made between the two ships at first. The original inquiry established that in the critical minutes before the collision, Andrea Doria gradually steered to its left, attempting a starboard-to-starboard passing, while Stockholm turned about 20 degrees to its right, an action intended to widen the passing distance of a port-to-port passing. In fact, they were actually steering towards each other, narrowing rather than widening the passing distance. As a result of the extremely thick fog that enveloped Andrea Doria as the ship approached each other, the ships were quite close by the time visual contact was established. By then, the crews realized that they were on a collision course, but despite last-minute maneuvers, they could not avoid the collision. In the last moments before impact, Stockholm turned hard to starboard and was in the process of reversing her propellers, attempting to stop. Andrea Doria, remaining at her cruising speed of almost 22 knots, engaged in a hard turn to port, her captain hoping to outrun the collision. Around 11:10 p.m., the two ships collided, Stockholm striking the side of Andrea Doria. So that's where we are, the point of impact of the two ships at sea. I guess it makes a little more sense with the fog, being what it is. But still, I mean, it's got to be scary as hell with you think you're going one way, the other one thinks you're going the other, and all of a sudden, out of the fog, boom, or as they said in the 90s, whoop, there it is.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Two shows nightly. Tony Bruschi, everybody. Tony Bruschi. Tip your waiters and waitresses. So the guy, it's kind of the perfect storm there. His first time being the man in charge. He's been up since 6 in the morning. He has been, and I would imagine he's not unique or she to other captains back in the day where you're getting not a lot of sleep. You're doing a few other jobs before you actually are doing your most important job. But in a situation like that with fog and thinking you're going the correct way, whether he was well-rested or not, or whether he was a veteran or not, it almost sounds as though this was somewhat unavoidable.
In many ways, it does. I mean, they were basing it on what sort of equipment they had at that moment in time. And, I think obviously no one's trying to sink their ships, but it clearly did not work out well. Here's a fun fact. The Stockholm, still around.
So it did not have a lot. Clearly, it was not put out of commission.
It was put out of commission temporarily because this whole bow got ripped off, but it did make it to port, and it is still out there. It is now the MS Astoria, and it right now during as we're recording this during the pandemic, it's docked, and it may actually never sail again. But prior to the pandemic, it was. Used for 13-night cruises. Its last one being in October of last year, December of last year, I believe. It was scheduled for one to go off in October of 2020, but I don't know obviously that didn't happen because we're well beyond that. So that it may be on its last legs. It may be one of the many, many, many ships that end up in the boneyard, but it is the oldest. It's got an interesting title to it, which is kind of the oldest passenger liner still sailing deep water routes in existence.
Would that interest you to, oh, honey, what would you like to do tonight? Go for a walk, hit a Target, take a cruise on a ship that was collided with back in 19 such and such?
100%. Yeah. I it would be interesting to see what the ship looks like today. There was times in its life, it looks like in 93, it got refitted again to be a passenger ship as it had turned into something else for a short period of time. So it looked like it was in pretty rough shape. But it would be interesting to see just, you know, I love looking at these old vessels, and especially the passenger ones. I'm not into military ships. I really don't care about that. But the passenger, the slice of life type things where people spent happy times that are no longer there really fascinate me. That's why I'm fascinated with defunct shopping malls. It's why I'm fascinated with much of downtown Detroit, and large buildings that were once these opulent hotels and shopping centers and, you know, places of so much joy and excitement, and now just sit rotting away. I don't know what it is about it, but it's that kind of creepiness that really draws me in.
So it interests you to go into a Woolworths, if you will, as though it just randomly stopped one day. Literally, the cash drawer is still open. There's $17 in it, and everything is there. It's not barren shelves. It's fully stocked, as it was in 1993.
Funny story. Literally, right before we did the show, right before you dialed over to me, I was on eBay. I was looking up Woolworth's letter signs, because every once in a while you can find one on eBay that somebody has in possession of from the side of a Woolworth building. And I'm talking the old red sign, and there were letters that were attached to the buildings. And I've been trying to find one, because I just like to put one on my wall. Because I remember going to Woolworths as a child. It was in the end days of your downtown Woolworths, but I remember going to the lunch counter, and I had many fond memories there. But even at that time in the early 80s, it was like this was like a slice of the past that my mom was showing me and telling me how she used to go there when she was a kid. And, you know, it was probably like when I was around 10 that it closed down. But I remember it, and it was an interesting thing. And that store, that brand holds interesting pieces in American history. And I'm fascinated by those things. I'm fascinated by the fixtures and the architecture of places like that. I was trying to get my hands on, there was a department store in Wisconsin. You would know about this. Many of our listeners would not, called Prangyway. And I had I loved going there as a kid. I would get my candy there, all that. They all went out of business in the early 90s. And many of the malls that they were in, because they were mainly in malls, turned them into something else. There was one in Manitowoc, Wisconsin, where it still sat vacant until the mall got torn down about 2 or 3 years ago. And the Prangyway sign still was in the mall. It was like literally in the mall on the holder. It had not been touched since the store got closed down. And I actually called around trying to figure out who owned the damn mall, or who could put me in touch with who's ever in charge of who has this property, because I wanted to buy the sign and I didn't know what I was going to do with it, but I wanted, like, I was going to have my dad go and pick it up and I get it from him at Christmas or something, but it was a big mall sign and I could never find out who to talk to get it, but I knew it existed. And eventually they tore the mall down and I'm sure that sign went with it. But there's just something about things like that, retail, just happy places, happy times that are defunct, that draw me in, and I don't know what it is, but it is.
So you saw the sign, this was on the exterior of the building?
It was an interior mall sign.
So you actually were in the mall and you saw it, or window?
I have seen it, and then I'd seen pictures in it, because believe it or not, there's other people that are fascinated with defunct malls as much as I am, and I had seen it on video that it was still up into the early parts of the 2000s when I was looking into it.
I mean, because honestly, I'd like to think that their security system, they weren't paying their ADT bill anymore.
You could probably get out of the mall if you really wanted to.
And hey, look, there's a deer. We'll wait for just before the sun goes down, bring a stepladder, a little giant, and go to town.
It would be a little awkward to say, what did you get arrested for once in your life? Stealing a Prangyway sign from a defunct Prangyway in Manitowoc, Wisconsin.
Could there be a better way to be incarcerated?
I don't think there really is. I don't know. I love, speaking of ships here, and we'll go back to the Andrea Doria. In Manitowoc, the SS Badger sails across Lake Michigan in the summer months. And I've been on that a gazillion times, and that's a really fascinating ship to look at. Last coal-powered ship that sails the Great Lakes, and I believe it's been converted now, but it was the last. It almost went out of service completely, and its sister ship, the Spartan, sits over in Ludington, and it just sits there. It used to be rotting away, and it looked really creepy when you would come into port. They've since painted it and made it look nice, but they now go to that ship for spare parts when the Badger has problems. But it is like a 1950s ship, and it's interesting just to see the architecture, and it's a slice out of another point in time, and that really
interests me. I'm more interested in more modern times, like the 40s, 50s, or 60s, and experiencing things like that than I am like, you know, 1845, let's go to the old general store type thing. The more of a like grandparent type time where they would have lived, it would have been their excitement and what they saw as new drives an interest for me for whatever messed up Aspie reason that is. But that's how my brain works. So let's continue into the story of the Andrea Doria and the collision with the Stockholm off the coast of Nantucket. The Andrea Doria, the morning after the collision with the Stockholm in fog off Nantucket Island. The hole in her starboard side from the collision with Stockholm was visible near the waterline, about one-third aft of the bow. When Andrea Doria and Stockholm collided at almost a 90-degree angle, Stockholm's sharply raked ice-breaking bow pierced Andrea Doria's starboard side with about one-third of her length in the bow. She penetrated a hull to a depth of nearly 40 feet and the keel. Below the waterline, five fuel tanks on Andrea Doria's starboard side were torn open, and they filled with thousands of tons of seawater. Meanwhile, air was trapped in the five empty tanks on the port side, causing them to float more readily, contributing to the ship's severe list. The ship's fuel tanks were mostly empty at the time of the collision, since the ship was nearing the end of her voyage, worsening the list. Andrea Doria was designed with her hull divided into 11 watertight compartments separated by steel bulkheads that ran across the width of her hull, rising from the bottom of the ship's hull to the A deck. The only openings in the bulkheads were on the bottom decks, where watertight doors were installed for use by the engine crew and could be easily closed in an emergency. Her design specified that if any two adjacent watertight compartments were breached, she could remain afloat. In addition, following the rules and guidelines set by the International Conference for Safety of Life at Sea of 1948, Andrea Doria was designed to handle a list, even under the worst imaginable circumstances, but not one greater than 15 degrees. However, the combination of the five flooded tanks on one side of the five empty tanks on the other left her with a list that, within a few minutes of the collision, exceeded 20 degrees. While the collision itself penetrated only one of Andrea Doria's watertight compartments, the severe list would gradually pull the tops of the bulkheads along the starboard side below the level of the water, allowing seawater to flow in. Corridors, down stairwells, and many other ways it could find into the next compartment in line. The collision also had torn into the access tunnel running from the generator room, which was located at the compartment directly aft of where the collision had happened, to a small room at the forward end of the tank compartment containing the controls to the tank pumps. But a fatal flaw in Andrea Doria's design existed, as at the point where the tunnel went through the bulkhead separating the two compartments, no watertight door was present. This allowed the generator room to flood rapidly, contributing to not only an increase in flooding, but also to a loss of electricity. Initial radio distress calls were sent out by each ship. In that manner, they learned each other's identities. Soon afterward, the messages were received by numerous radio and Coast Guard stations along the New England coast, and the world soon became aware that two large ocean liners had collided. Immediately after the collision, Andrea Doria began to take on water and started to list severely to starboard. Within minutes, the list was at least 18 degrees. After the ship separated, Captain Kalmai quickly brought the engine controls to all stop. One of the watertight doors to the engine room may have been missing, though this issue was later determined to be moot. Much more importantly, however, crucial stability was lost by the earlier failure due to routine operations to ballast the mostly empty fuel tanks as the builders had specified, which is filling the tanks with seawater as the fuel was emptied would have resulted in more costly procedures to refuel when port was reached. Owing to the immediate rush of seawater flooding the starboard tanks, and because the port tanks had emptied during the crossing, the list was greater than otherwise would have been the case. As the list increased over the next few minutes to 20 degrees or more, Kalmai realized that no hope was left for his ship unless the list could be corrected. In the engine room, engineers attempted to pump water out of the flooding starboard tanks, but to no avail. Only a small amount of fuel remained, and the three intakes to pump seawater into the port tanks were now high out of the water, making any attempt to level the ship futile. Aboard Stockholm, roughly 30 feet of her bow had been crushed from torn away. Initially, the ship was dangerously down by the bow, but emptying the freshwater tank soon raised the bow to within 4 inches of normal.
A quick survey determined that the major damage did not exist aft beyond the bulkhead between the first and second watertight compartments. Thus, despite being down at the bow and having her first watertight compartment flooded, the ship was soon determined to be stable and in no imminent danger of sinking. On Andrea Doria, the decision to abandon ship was made within 30 minutes of impact. A sufficient number of lifeboats for all the passengers and crew were positioned on each side of the boat deck. Procedures called for lowering the lifeboats to be fastened along the glass-enclosed promenade deck, one deck below where evacuees could step out of the window directly into the boats, which would then be lowered down to the sea. However, it was soon determined that half of the lifeboats, those on the port side, were unlaunchable due to the severe list, which left them high in the air. To make matters worse, the list also complicated normal lifeboat procedures on the starboard side. Instead of loading lifeboats at the side of the promenade deck and then lowering them into the water, it would be necessary to lower the boats empty and then somehow get evacuees down the exterior of the ship to the water level to the boat. This was eventually accomplished through ropes and Jacob's ladders. In fear of causing a panic and stampeding of the starboard lifeboats, Captain Kamali decided against giving the order to abandon ship until help arrived. In the meantime, Second Officer Guido Bandeno made announcements over the loudspeaker system, instructing passengers to put their life belts and go to their designated muster stations. A distress message was relayed to other ships by radio, making it clear that additional lifeboats were urgently needed. The first ship to respond to Andrea Doria's distress call was a 120-meter freighter, Cape Ann, of the United Fruit Company, which was returning to the United States after a trip to Germany. Upon receiving the message from the stricken Andrea Doria, Captain Joseph Boyd immediately set course for the site of the collision, with a crew of 44 aboard and only two 40-person lifeboats. The assistance Cape Ann could offer was limited, but within minutes she was joined by other ships heeding the distress call. The U.S. Navy transport USNS Private William H. Thomas, en route from New York to Livorno, Italy, with 214 troops and dependents, also responded to the signal and made immediate progress towards the site. Her captain, John Shea, was placed in charge of the rescue operations by the U.S. Navy and readily ordered his crew to prepare their eight usable lifeboats. Also joining the rescue were the U.S. Navy destroyer escort USS Edward H. Allen. 44 nautical miles east of the collision site, the French line's Ile-de-France was eastbound from New York en route to her port of Le Havre, France, with 940 passengers and a crew of 826 on board. At 44,500 tons and 225 meters in length, the 30-year-old luxury liner was amongst the largest passenger liners on the North Atlantic run. On that voyage, having left New York the same day as Stockholm, she was under the command of Captain Raoul de Bodine, a well-respected veteran of the seas who had served the French line for 35 years. Upon hearing of the collision and distress call, de Bodine was first skeptical of the thought of a modern ship like Andrea Doria actually floundering, and knew that if he did steer back to the collision site only to find that the Ile-de-France was not needed, it would mean having to return to New York to refuel and delaying her passengers, which could have been a financial disaster for the French line. At the same time, he knew that if his services were needed, the French line would not question his actions in that case. Captain de Bodine made an attempt to contact Andrea Doria to learn more about the situation, which was unsuccessful. But after making contact with the Stockholm, Cape Ann and Thomas, he quickly realized the severity of the situation and that the lives of over 1,600 people were at risk. He quickly turned the Ile-de-France around and set a direct course for the stricken Andrea Doria. On board Andrea Doria, the launching of the eight usable lifeboats on the starboard side was yet another calamity of the night. As many of the boats left Andrea Doria only partially loaded with about 200 panicked crewmen and very few passengers. While other ships nearby were en route, Captain Nordström of Stockholm, having determined that his ship was not in any immediate danger or imminent danger of sinking after being assured of the safety of his mostly sleeping passengers, sent some of his lifeboats to supplement the starboard boats from the Andrea Doria. In the first hours, many survivors transported by lifeboats from both ships were taken aboard Stockholm. Unlike the Titanic tragedy 44 years earlier, several other non-passenger ships that heard Andrea Doria's SOS signal steamed as fast as they could, some eventually making it into the scene. Radio communications included relays from other ships as Andrea Doria's radios had limited range. The United States Coast Guard from New York City also coordinated on land. arriving at the scene less than 3 hours after the collision. As he neared, Captain De La Bourdine became concerned about navigating his huge ship safely between the two damaged liners, other responding vessels, lifeboats, and possibly even people in the water. Then, just as Ile-de-France arrived, the fog lifted, and it was possible to position his ship in such a way that the starboard side of Andrea Doria was somewhat sheltered. He ordered all exterior lights of Ile-de-France to be turned on. The sight of the illuminated Ile-de-France was a great emotional relief to many participants, crew, and passengers alike. Ile-de-France managed to rescue the bulk of the remaining passengers by shuttling its 10 lifeboats back and forth to Andrea Doria and receiving lifeboat loads from those of the other ships already at the scene, as well as the starboard boats from Andrea Doria. Some passengers on Ile-de-France gave up their cabins to be used by the wet and tired survivors. Many other acts of kindness were reported by grateful survivors. In all, 1,663 passengers and crew had been rescued from Andrea Doria. The badly damaged Stockholm, though, the use of both her own lifeboats and those from the stricken Andrea Doria took on a total of 545 survivors, of whom 234 were crew members from Andrea Doria. 129 survivors had been rescued by Cape Ann, 159 by William H. Thomas, 77 by Edward H. Allen, including Captain Calamali and his officers, and one very fortunate American sailor who slept through the entire collision and evacuation had been lucky enough to be rescued from the abandoned sinking liner by the tanker Robert E. Hopkins. Ile-de-France undoubtedly played the largest role in the rescue, having taken on a total of 753 survivors. Shortly after daybreak, a 4-year-old Italian girl with head trauma and 4 serious injuries. Stockholm crewmen were airlifted from that ship and the scene by helicopter sent by the Coast Guard and the U.S. Air Force. A number of passengers and some crew were hospitalized upon arrival in New York. Several months of hearings were held in New York City in the aftermath of the collision. Prominent maritime attorneys represented both ship owners. Dozens of attorneys represented victims and families of victims. Officers of both ships' lines had testified, including the officers in charge of each ship at the time of the collision, with more scheduled to appear later, and an out-of-court settlement was reached. And the hearings ended abruptly. So that would be rather disconcerting as you're trying to make sense of everything that just happened to you, and especially if you lost someone on that ship, one of the 40-some people who died, and the ship companies are just as quickly as possible trying to go, okay, well, can we agree to, without talking to everybody on board, and let's settle this so that we can't get sued anymore. I get it's business, but it's, you know, businesses are not humans. I know that, and that's something that I think people need to understand more. But at the same point, when you are interacting with humans and you are responsible for human life, you got to act a little bit more like a human when it comes to dealing with those lives if they are lost. It's not all business at that point anymore.
Sadly, you would like to think that is the case, but not sure we can really truly understand how we'd act unless we're in that position. But sure. I mean, the opportunity to settle before going through lawsuits, etc., that is clearly the best route to take.
Yeah.
I think they absolutely could have been a little bit more human, a little bit more humane, if you will, of how they handled it. But yeah. You want to be efficient. You want to seize as much non-emotional opportunity as possible. And then move along. But I don't really think there's a winning way that companies, the ownership could have handled it, regardless of what they would have done.
I think you're right. I mean, I think at some point, no matter what a company does, if that company in some way, shape or form was responsible for the loss of your loved one, there's nothing they could do that is going to be satisfying, because you can never replace that person with money, with anything. So there's always going to be a level of dissatisfaction and anger, and that rightfully so. It's just, I think people get more up in arms when things appear to be kind of going on under the table, that they don't know about, in an effort to shield themselves. And it's the justice thing. You know, we're in a world where very much it's pitchforks and let's, you know, crucify, you know, anything before we even really have all the facts yet. And I think we've always kind of been that way. You know, it feels like it's gotten worse in the last handful of years, but facts are important. And, you know, sometimes facts do take time to play out. You know, and it sometimes, and I'm not speaking specifically of this case, but sometimes really there isn't anyone to blame. It's human error. Maybe you can say, well, the error occurred on that side. Sure. But intentional and not intentional are two very different things.
And really it's all in the eye of the beholder of what you believe is intentional and not. If there's emotion involved and you lost a loved one, yeah. I think they can show you science. No, I mean, not science. They can show you factual data and that this was unavoidable based upon the conditions. And still you would think, well, they were not paying enough attention to this, that, or the other. Yeah. So
I would agree. Let's jump into the part of the story where we learn more about how it wraps up and what becomes of the shipping line and the ship and the passengers of the Andrea Doria. Both shipping lines continued to a settlement fund for the victims. Each line absorbed its own damages. For the Swedish-American line, damages were estimated at $2 million, half for repairs to Stockholm's bow and half for lost business during repairs. The Italian line sustained a loss of Andrea Doria's full value estimated to be $30 million. A U.S. congressional hearing was also held and provided some determinations, notably about the lack of ballasting specified by the builders during the fatal voyage and the resulting lack of seaworthiness of Andrea Doria after the collision. While heavy fog was given as the primary cause of the accident, and it's not disputed that intermittent and heavy fog are both frequent and challenging conditions for mariners in that part of the ocean, these other factors have been cited. Andrea Doria's officers had not followed proper radar procedures or used the plotting equipment available in the chart room adjacent to the bridge of their ship to plot and then calculate the course, position, and speed of the other approaching ship. Thus, they failed to realize Stockholm's speed and course. Andrea Doria had not followed the long-established rule that vessels approaching head-on or head-to-head both turn towards the right, to starboard. As Stockholm turned to starboard, Andrea Doria turned to port, closing the circle instead of opening it. Beyond a certain point, it became impossible to avoid a collision. Captain Kamari of Andrea Doria was deliberately speeding in heavy fog, an admittedly common practice on passenger liners. The navigation rules required speed to be reduced during periods of limited visibility to stop distance within half the distance of visibility. As a practical matter, this would have meant reducing the speed ship to virtually zero in the dense fog. Stockholm and Andrea Doria were experiencing different weather conditions immediately prior to the collision. The collision occurred in an area of the northern Atlantic off the coast of Massachusetts, where heavy and intermittent fog is common. Although Andrea Doria had been engulfed in the fog for several hours, Stockholm had only been recently entering the bank and was still acclimating to the atmospheric conditions. The officer in charge of Stockholm incorrectly assumed that his inability to see the other vessel was due to conditions other than fog, such as the other ship being very small, a fishing vessel, or a blacked-out warship on maneuvers. He testified that he had no idea it was another passenger liner speeding through fog. Andrea Doria's fuel tanks were half-empty and not pumped with seawater, ballast to stabilize the ship, in accordance to the Italian line's procedures. This contributed to the pronounced list following the collision. The inability of the crew to pump water into the port fuel tanks to right the ship and the inability to use the port lifeboats for the evacuation. Also, a watertight door may have been missing between bulkheads near the engine room, which is thought to have contributed to Andrea Doria's problems. Stockholm's navigating officer misread his radar, thinking he was on a 15 nautical mile setting, when in reality the radar was set for 5 nautical miles. Thus, he thought he was further from Andrea Doria than he actually was. He also failed to consult his captain, as was required by regulation. Both lines had an incentive to limit the public discussion of Andrea Doria's structural and stability problems. Stockholm's owners and another new ship, Gripsholm, under construction at Elsondo Shipyard in Italy, Andrea Doria's designers had and engineers had been scheduled to testify, but the hearings were abruptly concluded before their testimony could be heard due to the settlement agreement. The Andrea Doria-Stockholm collision led to several rule changes in the immediate years following the incident to avoid a reoccurrence. Since this was essentially a radar-assisted collision event in which overuse was made of poorly handled technology, shipping lines are required to improve training on the use of radar equipment. Also, approaching ships are required to make radio contact with one another. Both ships saw each other on their radar systems and attempted to turn. Unfortunately, one of the radar systems was poorly designed, resulting in the collision. Maritime craft today are required to turn to starboard right in a head-on situation. Later investigations and study, unanswered questions about the tragedy and questions of cause and blame have intrigued observers and haunted survivors for over 50 years. The fact that Andrea Doria and Stockholm were speeding in heavy fog and questions about their seaworthiness arose at the time. Captain Camali never assumed another command because the Italian line feared bad publicity. However, largely because the out-of-court settlement agreement between the two shipping companies ended the fact-finding that was taking place in the hearings immediately after the disaster, no resolution of the cause was ever formally accomplished. This has led to continued development of information and a search for greater understanding aided by newer technologies in over half a century since the disaster. Recent discoveries using computer animation and newer undersea diving technology have shed additional light in some aspects. Many years later, scientific study of the actions of the two crews indicated a probability that the third mate on Stockholm misinterpreted his radar in the minutes prior to the impact. Recent studies and computer simulations carried by Captain Robert J. Murin of the United States Merchant Marine Academy and based on the findings of John C. Carthers suggest Stockholm's third officer, Carstens Johansson, misinterpreted radar data and badly overestimated the distance between the two ships. The poor design, the radar settings, coupled with unlighted range settings and a darkened bridge makes the scenario possible. Some critics have suggested that a simple and avoidable and available technology, a small light bulb on the radar set aboard Stockholm, might have averted the entire disaster. Instead, he may have unintentionally steered the Swedish ship into a collision with the Italian liner. Studies of the actions of each ship confirm another factor that was long suspected, that once sight contact was established, Andrea Doria took an evasive action that increased the likelihood of a collision and worsened the situation. In other words, the Italian ship turned to its left and subsequently the Swedish turned to its right, which in the case of an impending collision meant that they turned towards each other. The best way to avoid a collision is for both parties to turn away by both going to their left or both going right. Hence the rules of the road, specifically the direction a ship should turn. If both ships follow the same avoidance rules, then they minimize the chance of collision. Doria's impact area revealed that Stockholm's bow had ripped a much larger gash in the critical area of the large fuel tanks and watertight compartments of the Italian liner that had been thawed in 1956. The question of the missing watertight door, although still unanswered, was probably moot. Andrea Doria was doomed immediately after the collision. In maritime navigation, all collision avoidance maneuvers are made based on the collision regulations. Although these rules have helped to mitigate the maritime traffic and also advised every vessel about the collision avoidance maneuvers that need to be taken in every situation, they have not stopped accidents from happening. After a deep study of this, a number of the issues that can cause a hassle and confusion for the officer on ward were identified. Extracted from distance, comparative review of collision avoidance systems and maritime and aviation, Hesham Adapskor, Ovin Turskin, and several others put a paper together that addressed the transfer to the traffic and collision avoidance systems of aerospace technology to maritime navigation to avoid such disasters. And that's probably true. Adapting some of the stuff that they use in aerospace to that can be, I would imagine, tremendously helpful. Would you agree?
I would. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Very good. It's amazing, these hundreds and thousands of interviews throughout the last 7 months where these national shows, and they have to say, your mute button is on. Your mute button is on. I apologize for my low level of attention there. You'd like to think that there is the same procedure that happens in the air. It should happen in the water, but we are learning very much here that it is not even close. And there are situations that, depending upon the weather conditions and the lighting, that would make such horrific accidents be able to occur. I mean, I don't understand. There's loss of life that's a possibility in the water. There's loss of life possibility in the air. You have passengers on ships in the water, and I just don't understand why there are varying levels of regulations and kind of minimum safety standards of ways to keep track of other ships that isn't up to par with airplane travel.
I do not know the answer to that. I think, you know, obviously nobody wants to lose lives, but they're also, you know, in the business where they sit there and they go, well, how can we follow the rules that exist for the lowest cost possible? And I think you may have, you know, some of that going on, and you always will. I mean, that's businesses are there to, you know, lower costs and make money and get their job done as efficiently as you can. But sometimes people will go far lower than they should be, or really be right on that line of acceptability. And then all it takes is an error to go well below that line of acceptability. And then you get a massive disaster to happen.
And what happens is the money that they were going to save, or however many dollars it was, in settlements, they end up losing more than if they just would have used whatever funds to up the game of safety. And hopefully, current day, we've risen to a point of a bit more safe and regulations.
But you've seen far fewer shipwrecks like this today than you would have all those years ago. But obviously they do still happen. So I think progress is certainly being made. And I don't know if there ever will be a level of perfection in anything. You can, you know, get really good and really, but there will always be human error. And if it's not human error, if it's like, well, you know, it's a AI that's running something, there will be error there too. Things will happen, but it's a matter of trying to minimize those possibilities as much as humanly possible.
I think it's a situation where anytime you realize you're going on a train, you're going on an airplane, you're going on a ship, anytime you're not driving, and oh, by the way, even if you are, there is a risk inherently of, you know, something terrible happening.
That's why you should always demand to drive the cruise ship that you go on. The first thing you do when you get on, they're like, hey, would you like a glass of champagne or a margarita? Like, no, I want to drive the fucking ship. Get out of my way.
No, if you'll notice my ticket here, I paid the additional $12.50 to be able to be the captain.
You might notice I'm wearing the captain's hat. I got it. It looks just like the one from Captain and Tennille's album. I got it at the thrift store on the way in. That means I get to go to the bridge. Take me there.
I paid for the Prime membership exclusively to get this overnighted, in addition to be ready for my cruise ship. Do you see it? Don't worry about the tag that's still on it, because I'm going to return it after I am the captain of this cruise ship. But excuse me. Show me to the bridge.
Can I take the margarita?
Show me to the bridge, goddammit.
Can I take the margarita with me?
No, officer. Put your pellet gun away. Take me to the bridge now.
Take me away. Take me there. And then you're locked away.
Come with me.
For the rest of your cruise. Creepiness. All right, that's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. Thank you guys for listening. If you like the show, press subscribe, whatever platform it is you listen to us on, and leave us a review there on Apple Podcasts. We greatly appreciate it. Until next time, for Sean and all of us at The Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.